Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pimble. Some bills move through a chamber quickly.
Senate File 159 makes several changes to current law on the assessment required for successful completion of a practitioner program.
First, the bill Republican Senator Craig Johnson floor manages a bill changing how a person will receive a teaching license.
Second, the bill allows the Department of Education and the Board of Educational Examiners to create an initial one-year license for teacher licensure applicants who have not yet attained the requisite score or who have not yet taken the assessment exam but who are otherwise qualified to teach.
No other senators speak in favor or against.
Could we have some quiet in the chamber, please? The senator from Buchanan, Senator
This Johnson, is one of many warnings from President Schneider this year for the room to quiet down. For this bill about licensing teachers, a total of 3 minutes and 22 seconds is spent from the time it is brought up to the time the body votes on it. It passes 48-0. When it comes before the House of Representatives on April 1st, it doesn't go so fast.
It's a compromise for the students who do not pass the present 25th percentile hurdle this exam places before them.
Republican Representative Tom Moore is the floor manager and delivers his opening remarks. But soon after, there are amendments to this bill that take the conversation in a completely different direction.
Well, I don't know about you all, but I certainly was surprised on Friday when we found out that UnitedHealthcare was leaving Iowa as a managed care provider.
Democratic Representative Lisa Heddens presents two amendments that would terminate the state's Medicaid managed care contracts in favor of a state-run system. UnitedHealthcare has announced it will leave Iowa sometime this year. In 2016, Iowa's Medicaid system went from a state-run program to being managed by private companies. This transition was controversial, and both parties admit there have been problems going to this kind of system. UnitedHealthcare's pending departure reignites criticism from the Democrats.
I think that Medicaid privatization has forgotten about the people that it serves in the state of Iowa. And I'm angry. I am angry at what has occurred. Reduction, denial, and determination are the top three issues that the Managed Care Ombudsman's Office has received in complaints since managed care was instituted in the state of Iowa. Reduction, denial, and termination.
Governor Reynolds says she ended contract negotiations with UnitedHealthcare because they weren't meeting performance measures. UnitedHealthcare says they're leaving because the state is underfunding the Medicaid system. There are around 425,000 people enrolled through UnitedHealthcare. Democrats are proposing they become part of a state-run system, but proposing Medicaid changes as an amendment to a bill about teacher certification isn't likely to go anywhere, but it gives them a stage to speak. Most speeches from a representative are limited to 10 minutes, but that rule doesn't apply to opening remarks. And for the next 50 minutes, Democrats hold the floor with sharp criticism.
Are we considering the ramifications of disruption to the people that are served under this program? Are we?
After these amendments are ruled not germane, the discussion returns to the teacher certification.
House File 513 does two important things.
So back to Representative Tom Moore as he explains the bill.
One, it requires the Department of Education to set a minimum score that considers the scores of the neighboring states and the current supply and demand of teachers in the state. And number two, it provides for a one-year license for those who have completed their prep programs, have been offered a teaching contract, but have not yet passed the assessment.
Supporters of this bill say it will allow more people to pass these tests. If a school district has an opening and has made what the bill says is a good faith effort to find certified teachers but can't, they would be able to hire a person who has the education but hasn't taken an assessment test. That new teacher would receive a waiver, allowing them to teach for 1 year. But after that, they would be required to take the test. This aspect of the bill concerns Democratic Representative Mary Masher.
people who are qualified, have passed the praxis exam, and do officially have their license could be bumped by an individual who has not. So how do you determine if somebody, a district, has made a good faith effort?
As I see it, that would be a determination. A good faith effort would be determined by the person doing the hiring, and then that would be overviewed by the Department of Education.
They don't overview them now. So where is that in the bill that they would be the ones to overview that?
I don't know that that's in the bill.
I don't think it's done, and I don't think it's in the bill. And that's concerning to me because someone who is actually qualified, has passed the exams, could be blocked out of being able to get that job because we have no accountability on the part of districts to determine whether they are or are not making a good faith effort.
Representative Moore says by loosening the requirements of the assessment, Iowa will gain more new teachers. He says there are many legislators in the chamber who became good teachers long before this testing requirement, and if he could, he would eliminate this testing requirement.
It amazes me that the only opposition for eliminating this exam totally is those who believe the exam establishes a high standard of excellence, when in fact it only creates a barrier. There is no data that can show the people who do not pass this test will not become good teachers. Likewise, it does not show that those who do pass this test will become good teachers.
In the last session, Representative Moore supported a bill that eliminated the test, but it didn't become a law. This bill, however, is not as aggressive, and it passes on a vote of 71 to 28. Because it already passed the Senate, all it requires is the approval of the governor to become a law.
None of us want dogs and puppies or cats or kittens, right, or any of the animals that we share our homes with, to be mistreated. And if someone does mistreat them, we do want them to be held accountable.
Haley Anderson is from Iowa Voters for Companion Animals. Last year, she lobbied for a bill that would penalize those who intentionally neglect, injure, or kill an animal. She returned to the Capitol this year to renew these efforts. Anderson says it can be hard to gain support for a bill like this in an agriculture state.
I can reassure them we are not impacting livestock in any way, shape, or form. We simply want our pets to be protected. And the link between violence to animals and violence to humans is so proven and studied that this really is even a community safety issue as much as it is an animal welfare.
A bill she supports passed in the House 96-0. It provides penalties to those abusing pets. In order for this bill to continue moving forward, it has to pass a Senate committee by the 12th week of the session, which is April 5th. This is due to a second final deadline. This deadline applies to the majority of the bills in the legislature, except for those concerning the budget or other fiscal issues. Bills must pass in one chamber and the opposite chamber's committee to stay alive. For example, this bill about animal cruelty has passed the House of Representatives. Now it has to be approved by a Senate committee to stay alive. It comes before a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee with Republican Senator Jason Schultz as one of the panelists.
This is the bill that creates a variety of penalties for mistreatment of animals and related issues. This includes raising penalties for animal abuse, animal neglect, and animal torture. These changes are made to the companion animal chapter, 717B.
Mistreatment includes not providing access to food, water, or having the animal confined in an area that harms or endangers its life. Tom Colvin from the Animal Rescue League of Iowa supports this bill.
It does a number of things that go to the issues that we're seeing around the state, unfortunately, with more and more frequency, very egregious acts of animal abuse, neglect, and torture that's happening around the state of individual animals. And we feel that this goes a long way in helping county prosecutors actually deal with situations that they're seeing in their areas.
Haley Anderson says it brings penalties in line with other states.
It clarifies animal torture as a first offense felony. Iowa is one of only two states without a first offense felony penalty for egregious acts of animal cruelty outside of animal fighting. That's critical for us to fix here in the state of Iowa.
Jill Altringer from the Iowa Federation of Animal Owners also supports the bill, but she suggests an amendment.
Iowa pet breeders do not want to see any animal abused. Okay, we raise dogs to be loved in homes as their family pets. But we also want to make sure that in 5 years, 10 years, whatever it be, someone doesn't say breeding in itself could be considered abuse or torture.
Democratic Senator Tony Pizzigiano asks why the House bill didn't have this language.
Yeah, was this offered in the House?
Yes, sir.
And it was defeated?
A different language was put on.
It's a different language, because I thought we had agreed to language. This is what everybody we've been working on for all year, right?
Yes, sir.
So we all agreed to?
Senator Bisignano suggests adding this amendment to the bill. If this happens, that means the bill will have to pass the Senate, then go back to the House, a risk that supporters say may not be worth it because even with the slightly different language, they want this bill to pass this year.
But I'm interested in this, talking to the House, because I'm still stunned they have a unanimous vote on this, so which speaks for the bill, actually. And I want to go over and visit with them, but we're certainly not going to stop it here.
The bill is signed out of this subcommittee without an amendment. Senator Schultz says in the past, he may have been more reluctant to support a bill like this, but he's received a lot of input from people in his part of the state in Crawford County.
From farm families, I know these people, and they're reading it in the paper. They know that I'm I don't know what the proper term for the, they know I love dogs. I love my pet dog, and they're like, and they don't understand, they see a disconnect between how I treat my animals and my previous refusal to support similar legislation, which was based on protecting the ag economy. Year after year, we keep dealing with this, and I'm becoming less convinced that there is a link to the next step.
A couple of days later, the bill comes before the full Senate Judiciary Committee, and it passes. It does not have an amendment. But even if it had an amendment, it would still have made it past the final deadline. It can now be debated in the full Senate. This is the weekly legislative program Under the Golden Dome from Iowa Public Radio. I'm John Pemble. Unemployment benefits may be limited under a bill that passed in the Senate along party lines, but it needs to be approved by a House subcommittee and a committee in order to make it past the final deadline. The House Commerce Subcommittee is chaired by Republican Representative Dave Dio.
I just kind of wanted to have a detailed discussion of this bill because, quite honestly, I mean, part of this language has been around for a little while, and there's parts of this bill that I'm not too crazy about, but I'll be open to amendments to it if depending on what the concerns I hear today.
This bill would put into Iowa code conditions that would deny a person from receiving unemployment benefits due to misconduct on the job. To qualify for unemployment, there is an application process from the Iowa Workforce Development. If an employer denies unemployment, there is an appeal process. Iowa Workforce Development Deputy Director Ryan West says there are around 30 to 50,000 appeals a year.
All walks of life come and file unemployment claims, so you really would be surprised in some of the stuff we hear.
Most appeals have a fact-finding interview to determine if benefits should be granted. This bill places 16 conditions for denying unemployment that deal with misconduct. Charlie Wishman from the Iowa Federation of Labor tells the subcommittee he opposes this bill.
We believe that this is written with very, very loose language that is up to much interpretation.
Wishman says it isn't necessary to define misconduct within Iowa code.
There's case law establishing what misconduct is that has been litigated since the creation of the unemployment system in 1936. So that's 83 years. 83 years of these kinds of cases being determined by the current statute.
Felicia Hilton, North Central State's Regional Council of Carpenters, says codifying what misconduct is won't allow unemployment investigators as much room to make judgments about cases.
You know, these types of situations do take some subjectivity. They take some understanding either on the employer side or on the employee side to determine if someone should be denied unemployment when they're terminated from work or for whatever reason, they're no longer working.
Morgan Miller from Ask Me Iowa Council 61 says the 14th item listed as misconduct is aimed at unions.
Being disqualified for unemployment if you create animus against your employer, that worries us, especially when it comes to union activity. I see that it says there's protections when it comes to state and federal law, but I think that when we take away that context that ALJs and fact finders are able to use, that it could hurt workers in the long run.
Fact finders are used to investigate unemployment cases, but in some situations, appeals go through administrative law judges, or ALJs. Morgan says the bill can put restrictions on what they can consider during an appeal. Mike Gronsdahl, who is the former Senate Majority Leader, is now a lobbyist for the Iowa State Building and Construction Trades. He has a problem with the fourth item in the bill that says dishonesty with the employer by the individual in relation to the individual's employment.
Which is an even bigger category of you know, open to interpretation kinds of situations.
Kelly Poschke with the Iowa Association for Justice is worried about the 10th item that says excessive unexcused tardiness or absenteeism.
As this codifies absenteeism or unexcused absenteeism, it leaves no exception for medical conditions. So we could certainly see a situation where this might swing it in favor of the employer who can now benefits can be denied to an employee who maybe has a work-related condition that was denied or some other serious health condition that prevents them from working.
In the lobbyists' declarations, none are registered in favor of this bill. Many are opposed, but most register as undecided, like Nicole Crane from the Iowa Association of Business and Industry. Crane says they do favor putting the definition of misconduct into Iowa code.
We do think that anytime you can put something in code, it just makes it clearer for everyone. So again, just wanted to add that to the conversation. We don't have any specifics to any of the 1 through 16, but we do think that clearly we want to make sure that workplaces are safe for all employees. And so of course we would support anything that if an individual does something that would jeopardize the safety of other employees or themselves, that should be considered misconduct and should be taken into consideration as well.
In the bill, misconduct is defined as a deliberate act or omission by an employee that constitutes a material breach of duties and obligations arising out of the employee's contract of employment. It continues to define it in another sentence Representative Dio says is hard to understand.
The second sentence in particular is 79 words long, and I would challenge anyone to understand what it means.
Representative Dio asks Iowa Workforce Development Deputy Director Ryan West about how the department would implement the 16 examples of misconduct listed in the bill.
Where it says misconduct includes but is not limited to all the following. So my assumption would be you would be the guys that would be writing rules for that. And so how would that be applied? And does it open it up to just anything?
I don't know if I have a good answer for you on that, Representative. Certainly that's possible. I think ultimately what we would need to do is build our policies and procedures around what the final bill is.
Ryan West says there is too much unknown right now to provide a concrete answer. The bill advances out of this subcommittee. A day later, the full Commerce Committee meets. Representative Dio explains it to the representatives.
So this bill, what the intent of this bill, I believe, is to maybe clarify, but maybe expand some of the reasons why an individual could be fired and then lose their eligibility for unemployment. And currently, a lot of this, has been there. Let me explain how the bill is sort of structured. Because what they did was they basically took some of the language and the definition of misconduct that's at the beginning of the bill, was taken, that was copied out of rules. In my opinion, it's the rules that are there are not very well written. So there are probably some things with this bill that I would like to change, but the first part of the bill with the definition is included as part of rules right now. And then following that is a list of multiple different itemized reasons why you might lose your unemployment. And some of them are in current case law. Maybe a few of them aren't. At this time, I would like to ask my colleagues to go ahead and support the bill to kind of keep this conversation going on this issue. I wanted to assure folks that our intention is not to bring this to the floor without some amendments to sort of fix some of the things within this bill. So,
Democratic Representative Charlie McConkie, who is one of three panelists from the subcommittee, opposes the bill. McConkie says it's badly written.
There's no good purpose for this bill other than it's all we've got 80 years of code that we've operated on. We've never had any problem in it. And I realize some of your members believe that people can just up and quit and draw unemployment. Well, I've 30 years in the industry, in the industrial foundry of the industrial maintenance, and all the hundreds of people I see come and go, nobody that quit their job has ever got unemployment.
Representative McConkie says some of the language in the bill is too vague.
Where if I actually, in a bar, and make a bad comment about my employer, which I'm sure I've done several times, but I could be fired without any unemployment. I mean, that's the way it's written right now.
Representative Dio reiterates that portions of the bill are not very well worded, and it's hard to understand. But he wants the committee to pass it up to the full House.
At this point, I think we're just kind of wanting to kind of keep the conversation alive, continue talking with the Senate, you know, just so that we, you know, I think there's some things in here that need to be changed, and I'm not going to disagree with you so on individual points and different lines in here. So we're going to keep working on it. I don't think if it comes to the floor, there'll be an amendment.
The bill advances out of committee on party lines. If it comes up for debate in the House and is amended, it will need to be debated again in the Senate. Since there are no more new bills for this committee to consider, it is done meeting for this legislative session. This is the podcast about the Iowa Legislature under the Golden Dome. I'm John Pemble. The E-Verify system is operated by the Department of Homeland Security. It's designed to compare information from a person's I-9 employment eligibility verification form, driver's license, and federal records to confirm someone is authorized to work in the United States. Using the system is optional, but in some states, it is mandatory. In the Senate, Republican Senator Julian Garrett floor manages a bill that would make E-Verify mandatory to hire someone. Senator Garrett says even though using E-Verify now is optional, around 3,000 Iowa businesses use it.
I've personally talked to a number of employers that do use the program, and every one of them has told me it's very easy to use, and they get accurate information back almost instantaneously, within a few seconds. It's very quick.
Senator Garrett says if people know companies are using E-Verify, it lessens the chance of someone who is in this country illegally to apply for a job.
If employees know that the business they're thinking of applying to use the E-Verify system, if they're not here legally, they don't apply. They know they won't qualify. So the system kind of enforces itself.
Garrett says the current system of employing people is not fair.
It's unfair to people looking for work who have to compete with illegal immigrants who will work for substandard wages, and to employers who obey the law but have to try to compete with other employers that cut their costs by hiring people who are in the country illegally.
The bill has penalties for employers knowingly hiring an unauthorized immigrant. If someone makes a complaint to the Iowa Workforce Development for such a violation, the department can take the company to court to require the employer to terminate the employee in question. The company would enter a 3-year probation period where they must file quarterly reports about all new hires. If they fail to do so, penalties include temporarily suspending the license for the business to operate. If there are future violations, those licenses could be permanently revoked. This only applies to the location of a company where they were employing a person who was in the country illegally. If it's a franchise, locations in other parts of the state would not be penalized. Democratic Senator Joe Bolcom says he opposes this bill. He cites information from Farm Bureau as to why they oppose E-Verify.
And what they say is, unfortunately, while E-Verify may not adversely affect some parts of the U.S. economy, it could have dire impacts on agriculture due to the lack of U.S. workers and the absence of a workable visa program. Requiring agricultural employers to use E-Verify without assuring that a workable guest worker program is in place could have a significant negative effect on U.S. farm production.
Senator Garrett says E-Verify results in 99% of those run through the system as approved. He says of those that aren't approved, 0.016% are later proven to be misidentified, or 16 out of every 1,000. Because the system will be required for all employers, Democratic Senator Zach Walls says hundreds of Iowans who are here legally will likely have a problem when they get a new job.
So like 150,000 people on average or so in the state of Iowa start a new job every year. So 0.16 out of 150,000, you know, about 450 Iowans at least every year who are going to be hired for a new job. And thank you, Senator Garrett. That illustrates my point.
As Senator Garrett delivers his closing remarks, he says Iowa should use this program.
We've seen how small the error rate is. And as I've pointed out, as of last October, the system has been improved markedly. That 0.016%, that's probably going to go down.
The Senate votes for the bill 33-14, with a few Democrats joining the Republican majority. This happens 2 days before the final deadline. Leadership from the House of Representatives does not schedule this bill for a House subcommittee. That ensures this bill is dead for the session, as it does not make it past the final deadline. Another piece of legislation that needs to clear a committee is a constitutional amendment restoring the rights of felons to vote. It's a priority for Governor Reynolds, but because it's a resolution, the governor's office can only urge the body what to do. There is no power of veto or signature to make it a law. A constitutional amendment must pass in the House and Senate during 2 back-to-back general assemblies, then voted on by the public. The House of Representatives has voted for the Felon Voting Rights Resolution 95-2. It's also passed a Senate subcommittee, but there were indications that the full Senate committee may not approve it. Hours before the Senate Judiciary Committee meets, Republican Senator Marionette Miller Meeks speaks during a point of personal privilege on the Senate floor with a personal story to urge the committee to pass it. She talks about her late brother, Michael.
Michael went into the Army after high school, was offered, because highly intelligent gentleman, was offered to go to officer candidate school, refused because he wanted to stay with his peers and colleagues that he'd joined the Army with, went to Vietnam, served in Vietnam, got a Bronze Star, came back to the United States, was treated very poorly when he tried to go to college and joined the Marines. Close to about 20 years in the Marines, we were called because Michael went AWOL, absent without leave. And because we were a family that was very mobile and didn't really have a homestead per se, there wasn't a lot of connection necessarily with Michael. We went and got Michael, found him, and Michael had had been alleged or accused of taking $1,000 from Marines that had come back from Okinawa.
Miller Meeks says he would not allow her family to defend him. He served a year in prison with a felony conviction. He later moved in with Miller Meeks and her family, where they learned he had a gambling addiction.
Now, Michael died a year and a half ago. less than a year and a half ago at Thanksgiving. His last gift to me was not to go in his van, yes, that we had purchased for him to help him, was to come home to us and allow us to care for him to his death. And that was a tremendous gift to me.
She says her brother was not given a military funeral, even though he served in Vietnam for 21 years.
He never had his military pension that he earned. But he had one 8-year-old girl who he took to her 8th birthday to the Beatles' A Hard Day's Night, who still had him as a hero, who pleaded with her husband to help him, despite the lies, despite the deceptions, despite the loans of money that didn't go for what they were intended. And so when you ask me why I supported restoring voting rights for felons, it's because of Michael. I don't know why these thoughts came to me this morning, but I feel that I'm guided to share them with you. Everyone has a Michael in their family or to whom they know. Michael never had another conviction, not even a speeding ticket, the rest of his life when he died at age 66. So I don't know if this story moves you or helps you, but there are good people out there who do bad things, misjudgments, make mistakes when they are younger. And I would ask you, I don't know where this is, but I'd ask you to remember Michael when you think about this story. I apologize for the emotion that I share with you. I think Michael would want me to share the story, although we rarely talked about it in public to other people. I never wanted to embarrass my brother, who was otherwise a good person, and I know that from the letters that came at his death. So I'd ask you to remember that, to carry Michael in your thoughts and your prayers, and also to pray for God's grace. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator Marionette Miller-Meeks, speaking on the Senate floor during a point of personal privilege. The resolution to restore felon voting rights did not receive a vote a few hours later when it came before the Judiciary Committee, which makes it ineligible. It does not pass this final deadline and is dead for 2019. This is Under the Golden Dome from Iowa Public Radio, a weekly show about the legislative process. I'm John Pimble. Special thanks for this show goes to our Statehouse reporter, Katerina Sestarik. She files daily stories from the Capitol, and you can read them at iowapublicradio.org. Kay Henderson from Radio Iowa always gives us a hand with so many stories. The press pool at the Capitol is also a valuable source of knowledge for all journalists working there. This includes Caroline Cummings, Barbara Rodriguez, David Pitt, Stephen Gruber-Miller, James Lynch, and Aaron Murphy. And I'm sure I forgot a few other good reporters as well. We'll catch you next time. Iowa Public Radio talk show team producers also give us some help. Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and host Ben Kiefer. The script editor for this show is Iowa Public Radio's news director, Michael Leland. On Fridays, we release a new show around 30 minutes long about what is happening at the Capitol. It's always published at iowapublicradio.org and the usual podcast distributors like Google and Apple. Under the Golden Dome is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.
Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.